You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. Let me make some space here. So we're very pleased to host today this event in which we're going to present the latest report by CAF, Corporación Andina de Fomento. I was trying to find the English, but it's not going to work, which is one of the most important regional banks in the world, development banks. And we're presenting today their latest report on their latest economics and development report, this time on the development of physical and cognitive skills. And the role in the development process. The report is this one. It's outside somewhere. You can have a hard copy or you can download it online too. This report comes in the context of Latin America that with some exceptions, has experienced very important improvements in its economic indicators. But there are still some important challenges ahead. So, for instance, of which, of course, the book talks about them. So productivity growth is still very slow, dragging down overall economic growth. The region is still highly unequal, and extreme poverty is still very present in many countries. Crime and violence is still very high, and it's, of course, a very important impediment for normal lives in the region. And infrastructure is often lagging behind. And what this report puts forward is some evidence, some very strong evidence, showing that the development of cognitive skills, which go beyond what we learn in school, can bridge many of these gaps. And I think that this is a very promising line of research that we're going to have a great discussion today, listening to many of the arguments and that are put forward in this report. We have a great and excellent panel today. We have Lucila Berniel, who's one of the authors of the report, and she's a principal economist in the socioeconomic research department at CAF. Julian Cristia, who's a former colleague of mine in the Inter-American Development Bank. He's a lead economist in the research department there. And Emiliana Vegas, who's going to moderate the event. She's one of our non-resident fellows here in Brookings at Global and at ESPLA. She's my countrymate. And she's the chief of the education division at the Inter-American Development Bank. So without further ado, what we're going to do is that Lucila is going to come and to the stage and present the highlights of the report, and then Emiliana is going to lead the discussion. So thank you so much for coming. Welcome to Brookings.
So thank you, Danny, for the introduction and all of you for being here and the interest on and for the interest in our report. I'll be very brief about the motivation because Danny already talked a bit about this. But despite all the progress that the region has made in the last two decades, there are many development problems that remain there, and most of them are related to human capital problems. But not human capital as years of education or educational attainment, but human capital as a set of skills. And by skills, we can think of many different things. We have math skills, cognitive, computational skills, interpersonal skills, technical skills. But what we did in this report is to start by dividing skills into three big domains of development. The cognitive domain, the social-emotional domain, and the physical domain. And even though this separation is a bit arbitrary, and it will be more clear in a moment why, it allows us to think more systematically on what are the cognitive or the intellectual aspects, the emotional aspects, and the health-related aspects that needs to be further developed in our population in order to allow for learning, because it is learning as a process that takes place along the whole life cycle with what will eventually lead to the production of skills that are more specific and that will help in producing good outcomes in life and work. So this is just one short statement summarizing the first part of the diagnosis that I will show you next. And it says that Latin America needs more skills, and these skills also need to be more evenly distributed in the population. And why more skills? Well, basically, we start in doing this diagnosis by trying to compare Latin America to other regions, more developed regions in the world. And this was more or less easy on the domains of cognitive skills and also on physical skills, but it wasn't that easy in the case of social-emotional skills. But I will show you some exercises next that tries to do this comparison between Latin America and more developed regions. Let me just give you a word about PISA and the cognitive dimension. We all know that our countries are not doing very well in this international standardized achievement test. For instance, we know that only 1 in 3 students reach the minimum levels required in the field of mathematics, but this fraction is much larger for richer economies. Is 4 out of 5 students that reach these minimum levels. And we also use PISA as a source of data that includes not only Latin American countries, but also more developed countries, in order to say something about the social-emotional side. And I will show you here an exercise that what it does, or what it assumes, is that you can interpret the decline in the performance along the test, from the beginning of the test to the end of the test, as a signal of the lack of perseverance, the lack of motivation, or the lack of attention that the student have in order to succeed in the test. And what you see here is the probability of a correct answer in the first question of PISA. And you see there that Latin American countries that are here on this side are doing not that well. In fact, the rate of correct answers is 25% lower in Latin American countries compared to high performers in PISA. But this share, or this fraction of probability, this fraction of correct answers drops a lot at the end of the test. So we can interpret this or read this evidence in many ways. We think that this information is conveying something about the social-emotional problems that our young population is having in Latin America. So here, for instance, you see that high-performer countries only lose 6% of this potential achievement or potential performance, while the drop in Latin America is much higher. And regarding the last dimension of development, the physical dimension, we know that the region has made a lot of progress in health outcomes, but there are still many problems there, inequalities, major health issues problem, among which, for instance, stunting is very serious, and of course it represents a very terrible starting point in the process of skills accumulation, especially among the vulnerable children. But given this broad diagnosis, we went one step further, and we conducted our own survey to try to understand better what are the relationship between the three dimensions of this, the three dimensions of skills development, and also how these dimensions relate to outcomes, to individual outcomes. So we did this survey in 10 cities, in 10 countries in Latin America: Buenos Aires, La Paz, Sao Paulo, Bogotá, Quito, Mexico City, Panama City, Lima, Montevideo, and Caracas. And we covered there 10,000 individuals, aged between 15 and 55 years old. And of course, we included there many measures of these three domains of development. And I will show you some results from this survey, the CAF survey 2015. Here we have some measures that we get from this survey in the three domains of development. And what I'm going to show you here is just a simple result, results, sorry, that show a strong and positive correlation between all these measures of development. And you can interpret this simple evidence as in favor of the hypothesis that says that the three domains of development go hand in hand. To develop cognitive skills, you need social-emotional skills. To develop social-emotional skills, you need physical development, and so on and so forth. But this strong correlation or complementarities that we find across individuals are also found in the labor market. What I'm going to show you here is a graph that will try to understand how skills are demanded across occupations. And we will summarize these requirements of skills in this two-dimensional space. In the x-axis, you will see an index that summarizes the requirements in the social-emotional side. And in the y-axis, you will see an index that summarizes requirements of cognitive skills, high-level or complex cognitive skills. And we will accommodate all the occupations that we will get from the CAF survey in this two-dimensional space, in these four quadrants that, of course, separate the space in occupations that did high and high, low and low, and the other two combinations. So what you see there are occupations. Each bubble is an occupation, and the center of these bubbles is characterizing the how much social-emotional or cognitive skills does each occupation requires, and the size of the bubble represents the share of employment in each of these occupations according to our survey. So occupations demand these two dimensions of skill together. This is the complementarity that I was talking about, and this is shown by this positive relationship between these two dimensions of skills. And here there are some examples of what are the occupations that we have in each of these quadrants. In the first one, we have managerial occupations. In the second one, we have many IT-related occupations. And then we have support occupations like administrative or cleaning. And here we have, for instance, drivers. And in the fourth quadrant, we have services, basically sales, customer service, and care services. Of course, all of these occupations are not equally good, in particular because of two reasons. Some of these occupations were or are at higher risk of automation, and some occupations pay higher salaries than others. And this is something that I'm going to show you now. In this yellow-orange area, you see those occupations that are least at risk of automation because of basically two reasons. These are occupations that imply less routine work, and also these are occupations that require more social-emotional skills, which we know are very difficult to be produced in machines or in robots. So, but in this orange area, we have two very different types of occupation. We have those occupations that require high levels of both type of skills, which also pay the highest salaries, and we have those occupations that pay the lowest salaries, that require low levels of skills, of cognitive skills, and high level of social-emotional skills, even though these occupations are also at low risk of automation. But this picture is already informing us something about the future of jobs in Latin America. What we do to say something more about this is try to look at the data and say whether this automation and polarization is already taking place in the region. By polarization, we understand this process that is very related to automation that says that with technological change, there is a change in the structure of occupations in which simultaneously there is an increase in the importance of low-paid occupation and low-skilled occupations and in high paid and high skilled occupations, while the occupations in the middle tend to lose in importance in overall employment. And this is what has been observed in many developed economies during the last two decades, and we replicated this work using data from household surveys for Latin America, and what we see there is that still this polarization seems not to be taking place, but this, of course, doesn't imply that it won't occur in the near future. So we could expect polarization to occur very soon, and we should be prepared for this. Regarding the inequality side of skills, I will show you here some just one graph that is comparing the measures that we get from the CAF survey in all these metrics across four groups in the population that differ among each other in the level of socioeconomic status, measured by the educational attainment of the mother, of the individual that was surveyed. And as we compare individuals of the highest level of socioeconomic status with those from lower levels, we obtain these differences. And I only want to highlight here that the highest differences are found not in the non-cognitive side, but in the cognitive side for measures of cognitive skills. So why should we care? We have said we have low skills that it are not very evenly distributed in the population, especially in the case of cognitive skills. And of course we should care because countries that have more skilled populations tend to grow faster, to be more productive, to be more innovative, to also be less unequal. But we also care because of the effects or the associations between skills and individual outcomes. And here I will show you some of these connections between skills and labor market outcomes, and also between skills and other life outcomes. Regarding the first dimension, the work outcomes or labor outcomes, we have these four type of outcomes correlated to the metrics of skills that I've shown you before. We have labor force participation, employment, labor earnings, and the quality of jobs measured by formal jobs. So what you see here is that in the first two columns, the association between these outcomes and skills is very strong for the case of non-cognitive skills. And what you see as a shaded cell is that measure of skill that seems to be more strongly associated to the outcome. In these two first columns is grit. And in the second two columns, you can think of those two columns or outcomes as measures of the quality of jobs, labor earnings and formality. The association with non-cognitive skill is still there. But cognitive skills start to appear as very important as well. So what you see here comes also from that exercise that I just showed you, are the coefficients of the regression in which the outcome is the labor earnings. And you see that all these skills in green are statistically paying, give returns in the labor market. And we have this funny thing here about that being nice in Latin America is not a good thing in the labor market, so you should be aware of that. but this is a fact that is also present in many other related studies. So, and going to the life outcomes, we have here many other sides of well-being or outcomes of well-being. The first two are related to educational outcomes, then we have health, physical and mental, negative outcomes of health, then we have civic engagement and life satisfaction. As you see, for educational outcomes as well as for civic engagement, social-emotional skills are important, but the most important seem to be cognitive skills, while for the case of health, it's the opposite. We have the social-emotional dimension seem to be very important. And for life satisfaction, what seems to matter the most is the physical dimension. So all skills are important for labor outcomes, either for the probability of having a job, of going to look for a job, or finding a job, getting a good one, and also in other dimensions of life, in education, health, civic participation, and life satisfaction. So given this importance that skills have, we need to understand how to foster how to promote the formation of these skills in our population. And we organized the book using a very simple framework that comes from the work of many disciplines that have been working on skills development, basically many of them related to neurosciences, and also from the work of economists like Professor Heckman and co-authors, that they propose this idea that skills are developed during the whole life, and the three domains of development are very related to one each other, and that the formation of skills operate as a building block process in which basic skills are the foundation for more complex skills. And we can construct many examples of how these skills are formed and how these different domains of development relate to each other. But of course, this development does not occur in a vacuum. There is an important biological process behind, and this process is more accelerated in the first part of life. Like an arrow that is thicker at the beginning, but it's not appearing there. But the important thing to say is that there is not only biological aspects there, but there are also some institutional aspects that are very important in the process of skills formation. And this is the view that we take in our book, and this is the way in which we organize the discussion around policies. And regarding this institution or contexts of skill formation, a key one is the family, and then the school, and then, of course, the workplace. But there is also the social context that condition the way skills may be formed along the whole life cycle. So I will be very brief about the messages that we get from each one of these contexts, starting by the family. Of course, families are in charge of many things. They do a lot of things for their children, but we will here be very schematic and say that families only do three things. They invest in time, in their children, in money, and they also put a lot of effort to construct or design rules and structure inside the household that will condition the way that all interactions at home take place. And of course, this will impact or help or limit the formation of skills. They do this, they make these decisions in two crucial moments, before birth and after birth, but they decide facing some constraints regarding time, financial resources, information, knowledge, and also the mental health of caregivers can condition a lot the size and also the productivity of investments that family made in their children. And we document that these constraints are not equally important for all families. They are very important for, especially, most of them are very important for poorer families and some others. And for some other constraints, it's not that obvious who is more constrained. So I will give you here just five messages. The first one, and very related to previous literature, says that there are very large socioeconomic gaps in skills that appear very early in life. And we document that these gaps are very related to differences in the way that families invest in their children. And even when all these investments are important, there is an investment that is key that has to do with time and quality time in particular. We also document how family investment can be much more productive when they are in environments that are well endowed with other complements, for families that live in areas with good infrastructure, for instance, with good provision of clean water and sanitation. And I'll describe very briefly five groups of policies that can help families to invest in their children in a better way. These five groups of policies, the first three have to do with alleviating the weight of these constraints that I described before regarding financial resources, time, and information. And the last two groups of policies are trying to see how families can complement better their efforts with the efforts or the contributions coming from other contexts, for instance, from the social context or the environment, what we call there, and also the contributions of schools. So these last two groups of policies are talking about the need for the policies that complement better the contributions of the different contexts of skill formation. And going to schools, we, of course, can be talking about schools for years. I only will give you some brief comments here. We now, as economists, know a bit more about the production function of skills, in particular of cognitive skills. Now we have recognized the importance of several school inputs, infrastructure, but more importantly, teachers' quality, skills and practices, peers, principals, leadership, IT, the length of the school day, school organization, material, infrastructure, and so on. And we also have recognized the importance of other inputs, especially those coming from family, other student characteristics, and, of course, the skills accumulated beforehand, since this process is a cumulative process. But, of course, to try to disentangle what are the marginal contribution of each one of these inputs and which is the contribution of the whole bundle of inputs that the school put to produce these cognitive skills is a very difficult thing to do. What I'm showing here is just an exercise that tries to separate how much of the variation in school inputs can explain of the variation of scores that we get from TERCE for the case of primary education and from PISA for the case of high school education. And we see here that the contribution of schools' inputs is larger for the case of primary schools. And also we see that among the inside this green area, the inputs that seems to contribute the most are those related to or measures of quality of teachers and teaching. Regarding the other inputs, you see there the importance, the big importance of family and of previously accumulated skills. But as we know something of cognitive skills, and we have learned about this very recently, we still don't know much about what is the role of schools to produce social-emotional skills and physical development. Neither we know a lot about what are the inputs that the school should put into this production function so as to get more social-emotional skills or more physical development. We know something, and we refer to that literature in the book on what are what is the contribution of teachers, of peers, and of the length of the school day in some dimensions related to social-emotional development, but still there is a lot to do here. And at CAF and, of course, at IDB and many other development institutions, and as well as in academia, there are a lot of initiatives to try to contribute to this part of skill formation that we still are very ignorant about. I give you just five messages here also. The first one says that Latin America has made a lot of progress in basically expanding the access to basic education. However, quality is very low still. And the second message is saying that the low level of skills at the entry age of children in schools is imposing a lot of serious challenges, not only to teachers, but also to schools' systems as a whole. And also, we document how the contribution of school inputs is very related, not only to the quality of these inputs, but also to the quantity. And we show how many countries in Latin America still need to invest more in education. Fourth, we document how social interactions inside and outside the schools are very important for skill formation, especially in for adolescents. And we discuss many policies. Here I will highlight only five groups that have to do with teachers, with students grouping, for instance, this discussion about tracking or teaching at the right level, and also the group of policies that have to do with IT at the schools, with extra hours, and of course with early childhood education. Regarding the role of shops, so here we know that shops or the workplace or the labor market enter the life of the people when this biological progress process is more or less done. But still, the labor market is very important to form skills because of many reasons. For instance, we spent very long years in the workplace or in the labor markets. The typical Latin American that works for 40 years is in the labor market for during 40 years, while he or she is in education during only 9 years or less. So we have plenty of time to be there and try to learn something. There is also this idea and evidence that supports this idea that says that that jobs are a key way to maintain people active, socially active, physically active, and intellectually active. And this activity is contributing maybe not to increase some skills, but for sure to avoid the depreciation of most of skills that have been accumulated before. And also the labor market or shops or the workplace is an important thing for skills because labor markets send signals back to other contexts, informing families, informing schools, what are the best investments that can be done to take advantage of the returns that the labor market offers for skills. So I'll give you here just two messages. The first one says that the workplace is still an important context of skill formation, and I will talk here about the on-the-job skill accumulation that takes place basically through three different types of channel. The first one is the typical, is training. The second one has to do with learning from peers, and the last one has to do with learning by doing. And we try to decompose what is the contribution of these three channels to skill formation during job or on the job skill accumulation. And we get to these results regarding technical skills and also interpersonal skills. This is self-reported data. It's coming from self-reported data from our CAF survey, and this is an exercise of that is trying to decompose the contribution of each of these channels, similar to the one I've showed you before for schools. And it says that basically all the learning or the skill accumulation in the workplace takes place through informal channels, through learning by doing and learning from peers. But not all workers benefit equally. Those that benefit the most are those that get to the labor market with the highest set or higher stock of skills, and that again speaks about the importance of previously accumulated skills, but there are also two reasons or two groups of people that benefit a lot about from skill formation coming from these three channels. And these individuals are those that work in formal environments, formal firms, and those that are well matched according or for whom their skills are well aligned to the tasks they perform at work. So regarding these two last group, what is the situation in Latin America? And we unfortunately are not very well prepared to activate these channels because of the pervasive presence of labor informality in the labor market, and also because of this mismatching of skills to tasks that we get from our survey. About 43% of individuals report to be mismatched to the tasks to the type of job they have. So, and another message related to this one is that labor trajectories affect the way or the working of these channels. And basically, the idea is very simple. Skills that are not used will be depreciated. And we have evidence coming both from the informality hypothesis and the idea that unemployment spells depreciate skills. For the last one, we have evidence showing that in the case of Peru, the depreciation of skills in long spells of unemployment is very accelerated. And for the case of comparing the formal and the informal sector, what I'm going to show you here is just the same bubble graph that I showed you before that shows that many of the jobs in the formal sector use or demand cognitive skills, while this demand for cognitive skills is much lower in the informal sector. So those individuals that work in the informal sector will be more likely to use their cognitive skills. In the formal sector will be more likely to use their cognitive skills, and we can expect maybe less accelerated depreciation of those skills. I'm sorry. That's the only thing. The last thing I will show you. The evidence. This is an RCT, an experimental evidence that shows that the starting point is very important for labor trajectories and therefore for the path of skills accumulation. And we see here two comparable groups. One of them received the possibility of working in a formal firm and the other did not. And we see that the probability of formal employment afterwards is much larger for those that had the possibility to work for a formal firm for a short period of time. So just some bullets that try to summarize the conclusions for each one of the fourth environment that I just discussed before. But let me just give you the when, the what, and the who of public policies to foster skills in Latin America. We see that even though the first part of life is key to skill formation and we should put a lot of effort there, there are also other moments in life that are important, especially those that have to do with the transition between contexts. Regarding the what, we know or we can read this evidence in a very broad way and say that the policies during the first two decades need to promote equal opportunities, while in the later, in the last part of life or later, policies need to look for a better allocation of human resources across occupations, especially fighting informality. And the who, you know this now, that this process of skill formation is very complex. There are many institutions or contexts interacting. There are therefore many public agencies that need to coordinate actions, in particular not only education or the Ministry of Education, but also social development, health, labor, and even the infrastructure or planning public agencies. So that's it. Thank you very much. You can download the report from this link here. Thank you.
Report, which will also focus on skills for our region, and the World Bank has announced that their World Development Report next year will be on education. So I think there's an increasing conscience among people who work in developing countries that unless we can raise the levels of learning and the skills of our populations, and also, as Lucila said, ensure that they're better distributed, we won't achieve the levels of development and poverty reduction that we are working so hard from these banks. I was puzzled, and also given my role as head of an education division, by the graph where Lucila shows the very low impact that schools as institutions have in fostering these skills. And of course, there's a lot of literature focusing on trying to disentangle the effects of kind of the individual and the family vis-a-vis what the school does. And the literature, like your paper, often relies on the data that is readily available and is often about these kinds of inputs that are that you can observe. But there's more recent literature that I wanted to highlight, which is perhaps more difficult to generate because it involves actually going into classrooms, observing what's happening, going into schools and seeing the processes in place and how actually teachers and students and principals interact that quite strongly indicates that it's the quality of these interactions that really make a difference. So it's not the quantity of inputs, but it's really the quality of how teachers and school leaders actually do their work and how they interact with students that does generate differences in skills. And one of the characteristics of high-performing systems is that they train differently and they focus on these interactions rather than just content knowledge and cognitive skills, let's say. So I wanted to say that to start because we shouldn't be in despair by looking at, you know, how, you know, all of us who are parents have kids in schools. Some of us pay a lot of money to have them in certain schools. So, it, you know, as a parent who has right now two kids in private schools, it was like, oh, my gosh. And one of them is a boarding school, so even more, oh, my gosh. So, no, I am convinced that one of the reasons I choose to have my kids in certain schools is that I observe a different environment and different quality of interactions, and I can see what the effect that that's having in their human capital accumulation. I wanted to also say that this evidence is based on correlations and kind of analysis of multiple variables and how they correlate with the outcome of interest, whether it's labor force participation or earnings. And another way or another strand of research is trying to look through a different kind of methodologies, through randomized controlled trials or quasi-experiments to try and see whether changes in these inputs can really make a difference. And that also, I think, has provided some different light into whether schools matter and whether teachers matter. There's a lot of research in this country that uses panel data that can really match students to teachers over time and looks into what are the practices of teachers in classrooms and can distinguish effective teachers from non-effective, and their impact on students is important. in terms of the skills they accumulate and the impact of having effective teachers over time seems to be quite strong. We also at the IDB have a large-scale study in Ecuador where we've been following a cohort of students since they were in kindergarten, and now they're in third grade, and have observed teachers through video recordings and really have documented that effective teachers do achieve much higher levels of learning in students, and that effective teachers can work and achieve these levels with students of various backgrounds. So the key then for policy, and I think it's a finding that you highlight, too, is to improve the quality of the adults in the system who are interacting with students, and particularly with students from disadvantaged backgrounds, who are the ones who are kind of getting cheated the most. I mean, none of our students are really learning a ton, as PISA shows. Even the wealthiest students are performing below the levels of the poorest children in some of the high-performing countries like Singapore and Korea, which is very depressing. But also, our poorest kids are really at a huge disadvantage. And just to I guess can kind of lead and then pass on the opportunity to speak to Julian and then to all of you to ask questions. You know, a key thing is how rapidly the world is changing and how our systems are still quite traditional in the way they're organized. And I think a big challenge for our region in particular, but really for all the world, is to recognize that we are forming individuals for jobs that today don't exist. And so that the big challenge is how do we build skills that we don't know really what they are, but I guess the key one is the ability to reinvent yourself and learn new skills throughout your lifetime. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge, one that I know you're tackling in that other report. So I'll pass it to you to make some comments, and then we'll open it up.
Great. Okay, so first I want to thank Lucila for the invitation to be here. It's really an honor for me to be in Brookings, and always I want to thank Brookings for organizing this event. So the second thing I want to say is I want to congratulate Lucila for a very nice report. I haven't read the whole report. I have read, you know, several parts, but it struck me as a very comprehensive report. This is a very wide topic, and even though it is so wide, they're really trying to cover many important aspects, so it's really comprehensive. And also, in some way, provides a nice conceptual framework about how to think about these topics. And so I think it's a great starting point if you want to know about these issues. It gives you, you know, the most important part that you need to think about. I also like the fact that it's creative, the way how they use PISA, looking at the performance in the first question versus the last question, the application to Latin America. I think it was really nice, and the results are quite surprising. And there are potential different explanations for those facts, but it's something that, you know, it kept you thinking. So it's something nice, not only what you learn, but also that it gives you some question that you want to know more. So I really like that. So I think there is one message that for me is very important, but it's missing. And I think that for Latin America, we're making a big investment in skills, really major investments. We're spending in pre-primary, primary, secondary, and tertiary about 5% of GDP. This is a huge investment. Imagine infrastructure, we roads, ports, all that, we spend maybe 1.5% of GDP. We're investing 5% on this, just public investment. Just in primary, we spend 2% of GDP. And our students are not doing very good. Even if we compare not with OECD, with countries of similar levels of economic development, we are not doing good. So there is really a need to improve efficiency. We need to spend better. And in that regard, I think one of the big constraints is really lack of evidence. So today, Lucila presented a lot of very nice results that many of them are associations. But to think about policy, you need to know what is the effect of changing certain things on learning outcome. You need a rigorous impact evaluation. And let's think about concrete examples. So right now in Latin America, there is a big push for extending the school day. In many of the countries, students attend school for 4 hours a day. And several countries have already done it, and others are in the process of doing it, of extending the length of the school from 4 hours to 6 or 7 hours. So this is going to involve a major increase in spending. Like, you know, a conservative estimate would say that that would increase spending by maybe 40 to 60% in per student spending. So here what we're talking about is that a country that was spending 2% of GDP in primary is going to spend 3%. So you say 1% of GDP. That's a massive investment. Okay, what is the basis for that decision? How many experimental evaluations are there about that? Zero. There's no. So we are about to spend, you know, for the reason, I think about $90 billion, and we don't have rigorous evidence on that. There are like three nice quasi-experimental evidence that have, you know, problems. How much does it cost to have a nice evaluation of that policy? Maybe $1-2 million. So we are going to spend $90 billion, and we don't know what we are doing. And let me give you a couple of more examples of really this that I see as a critical constraint for policy making and for really improving outcomes. There was the program One Laptop Per Child that started, it was launched by MIT and was implemented in 50 countries around the world, and they distributed more than 2.5 million laptops. Basically, they wanted to improve education in the poor regions of the world by providing personal laptops to students. In Peru, we collaborated with the government of Peru and a think tank, GRADE, and we ran a rigorous evaluation, an experimental evaluation of that program. It was very important because the government was spending $2 million on this program, but they were, I think, really brave and really, I think, committed to run an experimental evaluation of the program. What did we find? There were no effects on learning in math and language. That was the main objective of education ministry. So basically spending $2 million. And this is even a little bit worse because we did a review in 2014 and we found that countries in Latin America have distributed already 10 million personal laptops to students. So this, making a conservative estimate, is basically they spent $2 billion distributing laptops, but it seems that there's not much return, okay? So big investments, little results, we need more evidence. But let me give you like a positive example, right? I don't want to be the negative here. So let me give you a positive one, and there are positive ones. There is, for a long time, psychologists have been thinking that motivation is key for learning. And if you think about Abraham Lincoln, you know, if you read his speeches, are unbelievable. They're amazing. He's one of the best presidents, the kind of speech that he wrote. How many years of education he had? He had 3 years of education, okay? So, but he was a person that was really motivated about learning. He lent a book, he read a lot. At some point, there was a wealthy person giving books. He lost one of the books, he had to work 1 week to pay back the book, okay? So, but he did it. And then when he was 18, he figured out that math was important. He studied math for several years. So motivation is key, okay? So what they say, psychologists think that many times the problem is that people think that they are not smart and so that they shouldn't spend time reading because they cannot do it, basically. So there is a very simple intervention that was designed in Stanford and done in Peru and evaluated with a large experimental evaluation where basically they show kids, they do one session, 2 hours, and they show that the brain is as any other muscle, and if you train, you can improve. That was it. One day, they show it, they do it in a very active way, they explain to them, then they have to write a letter to a friend telling this, and then they put all the letters on one wall. So later on, they came back, and they measured the effects of this. There was positive significant effects on learning of that intervention. The effects are about similar in terms of math and language of extending the school day, okay? This is incipient, this is emerging evidence, okay? We have to be careful, but what we have. What is the cost? The cost is $0.2 per student per year. So minimal cost. So there may be many other things like that that we don't know, basically. So I think that one very, I think that in the report, they talk about it, but I think that really we have to communicate that we need to spend in evidence to make better decisions and to improve outcomes.
Thank you, Julian. Lucila, would you like to comment on our comments, or are you ready for questions?
No, just to thank you, both of you, and also try to also call for more evidence and for more causal evidence on this issue of what is the impact of schools or what are the impacts of different inputs into the production of cognitive, but especially non-cognitive skills, since we know that these type of non-cognitive skills are also an input to produce human capital, as we understood human capital before. So just again to thank both of you, not only for this comment, but for all the work that we have learned from your papers. And from CAFI are trying to build an agenda on these topics. We are also working on many RCTs, trying to give and to contribute to the evidence or the stock of evidence from which governments should base the. Yep. Hola. Hi. Yep. Okay, so sorry, and thank you very much for the. again, just to thank you and to say that we are in the same agenda, trying to provide more evidence for the governments of the region on these aspects.
Thank you. Well, now I think it's the time for all of you to ask questions to our presenter. Please go ahead.
I think it's very important for Latin America in general to have more research, especially in education and different skills. My first question to the principal researcher, Lucila Bernil, about the 10 cities that were selected for the research are main like principal cities in Latin America. They are compared to other places in Latin America are very industrialized and are big populations compared in Latin America. Do you think it will be a change in the result of the research based on the location? For example, instead of selecting Buenos Aires to select Cordoba, or instead of selecting Sao Paulo to select one of the northern areas of Brazil? And also for you, Mr. Julian, about the process of evaluating and the process of implementation. You bring a brilliant example of how they evaluate a program in Peru, which actually came from research in MIT. But also that research bring to Uruguay the Plan Ceibal, which is a different plan to implement more about computer literacy. How do you think that the change in implementation between Peru and Uruguay can change the process of utilizing in a efficient way the resources for education? And thanks for all of this.
Before you sit down and for the others who may want to ask questions, can you just state your name and your organization? Should we take a couple more questions and then I'll give you? Okay. Back there.
Hi, my name is Graciela Sandoval. I'm from the National Geographic Society Education. And I have a question, being a geographer. Have you also looked at a comparison among the cities, specifically to look at their educational resources, such as textbooks and supplemental resources, and technology literacy, both of students and teachers, and how to improve professional development and certification of teachers, as well as the structure of schools and their funding source, looking at specifically how they're funding for the internet and bandwidth improvements. These are all topics that have been discussed with reports such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that did a recent report on teachers and how they utilize social media to talk about their profession and even how they're certified in technology. Thank you.
Thank you. Up here, one more question, and then we'll...
Yeah,
he'll give, just wait for the microphone.
Yeah,
and do you mind stating your
name? My name is Alejandro de la Puente. I'm Peruvian, but I'm a science policy fellow here at the National Science Foundation. So very interested in education. First question is, those 10,000 people that you sampled, they're everything, or are there 10,000 from schools, 10,000 in the workforce? I don't know, because if it's everything, I think it's a very small sample size. Second is, I think infrastructure is crucial. If you look at the plots that you showed that in the first quadrant, you know, you have high cognitive skills and high socio-emotional skills. But I can guarantee you that those people are pretty much from private schools in South America, not from public institutions. So if motivation is to be a key in the development of skill development or whatever, I think infrastructure is crucial. And I think coordination with governments is even more crucial, because the investments that you made are huge, but if there is this vacuum where the governments don't sustain that investment, then you will probably have, nothing will happen in public institutions, that's what I'm trying to say. So just speaking for Peru, though.
Thank you. Okay, I'll give a chance to our main presenter, and then we'll do another round. Do we have time for a second? Okay. Concilia, and then
so, thank you again for the questions. Regarding the first one, the cities, when you started asking the question, I immediately say, of course, this is the best that we can get out of skills from Latin America, since we are looking at cities that are mostly or more developed than the others. But then you mentioned Cordoba, and I'm from Cordoba. Cordoba is a good city. No, I'm kidding. The idea is that, of course, if we go to the rural side of Latin America, we will, especially in the, for instance, in the case of physical development, we will find very serious situations and a lot of inequalities. So this study that is small in a sense, but not in, and I will answer about that afterwards, is having done in cities. It will be ideal to extend it to other locations in Latin America, but for that we still need to advocate more and convince policymakers that measuring this type of things is important, and they should finance and support these kind of initiatives. But you're right. About the geography question, I didn't. Yeah, I understand that you were talking about the inequalities inside the city. I haven't heard of a study that takes into account the differences in school inputs inside cities in Latin America. But we are currently in an agenda to study inequalities inside cities. We haven't done anything on schools yet, but we hope to do some work in the future about this, because we know that inside cities inequalities are also very large. In some cases, these inequalities are larger than when comparing results or inputs across cities. And regarding the question of Alejandro Fuentes, De La Fuente, sorry. the sample size, the whole survey is 10,000 individuals, and it is small for some purposes and not for others. For the purposes that I showed you before, it's not small. And regarding your concern of who are those individuals in managerial occupations, I agree with you. Many of them come from high socioeconomic background, and you know, we all know that in Latin America, education is very segregated, and those that attend private institutions are coming also from richer families. And I agree with you with on this need that government need to sustain investment in infrastructure and in many other domains of public action during many years, so as to shorten these distances. In the type of education that public and public private and public institutions can provide, and also in the results or in the outcomes that we observe from people coming from different socioeconomic backgrounds. Again?
Great. About the first question, the role of implementation and the case of Peru versus Uruguay, I think that clearly implementation is crucial. You can have the best project in its design, but if you implement it in the wrong way, it's not going to work. So I think that implementation is key, and there is a need maybe to, you know, governments have to invest also in monitoring what they are doing and to have, you know, indicators and they can follow. And especially with internet, with a lot of tools that we have right now, monitoring is much easier than it used before. So we should do it and make sure that the processes are implemented correctly. The case of Peru, the case of Uruguay, there has been some evaluations about that particular program, and they show that really the program reduced inequalities in access to computers, for sure, but in terms of learning in math and language, the evidence is a little bit more mixed, even in the case of Uruguay. I think it's a case that they really did a very nice job in terms of implementation. And that, you know, in some way I want to connect with something I said before, that is, in many cases, it's not about technology is good or bad, it's how you do it. And in fact, a couple of years ago, Emiliana told us, we need to produce some report about, you know, technology. Does it help? Does it hinder? In which cases? So we did a review, and we were quite surprised about the evidence. So I said about there are no experimental evaluations about extended school day. Okay, in terms of technology in education, at that point there were 14 experimental evaluations, only developing countries. So with that body of knowledge, we were able to really try to see in which cases it worked and in which cases it did not work. And what we found was that programs that just center on providing resources and do not guide the use, do not provide guidance about how to use the computers, the effects were very, very low. In contrast, programs that guided the use of technology, in particular, we operationalized that term in terms of if they define the subject, if they define the software, if they define the schedule, the 3S, if they guide the use, then the effects were much larger and in general were very positive. And in fact, especially when they provided more time. So it was like 1 hour after class or something like that. We did that report, we found that, and then there have been several papers that were done after that that basically reinforced that the way of seeing that technology in a certain way can really help a lot. So it's a little bit connected with the second question about resources and internet and social media. I think that in many cases, because we observe that there are very big differences across society in terms of access, we think that access is the key, but many times you just provide access and basically nothing happened. It's like you have to go one step further and to ensure that the access that you provide is really well used. And yes, in terms of the question of Alejandro about infrastructure and coordination, so clearly infrastructure is key. There is a minimal levels of infrastructure that should be there, right? So there should be the school, the bathrooms. There are certain things that are crucial, and if they are not there, nothing is going to happen. So we have to ensure that every student have access to that. But many times I think that we are thinking that infrastructure is key because we see the private schools and they are so nice that we say, oh, that's a key. And so there has been experiences where governments make a big investment in really nice infrastructure facilities, and basically there are no effects. Because in some ways, like, you need the basic level. You need to get there. But after that, if they have a really nice gymnasium or not, it's not going to make a big difference. You know, I was really surprised. A couple of months ago, I went to a workshop in Peru, and after that, I have heard a lot about one school. This is school Fe y Alegría. There is a school Fe y Alegría that is located in the outskirts of the city in a very poor place, which basically is attended by very poor kids. And in 2011, it came first in the country in terms of math, in average score. So basically, it beat all the schools in the country, including all the private schools. And I went there, and I couldn't believe my eyes, because basically, they were playing in dirt, like the infrastructure was really bad. It was not bad. They had the minimal levels, but it was not like spectacular, right? But what you observe is, for example, they had one program that was called Me Gusta la Lectura, I Like to Read, where they tell kids that if they read a certain number of books, they get some bracelet and they can continue accumulating the bracelets. And that's it. I think that when they get to, I don't know, 500 books, they get a small radio. That's it. That's a program, okay? Me Gusta la Lectura, I Like to Read. That program is fascinating. I was in a third grade class, and they were like, how many books have you read? 300. Like, that's more than my daughter. You know, I should bring my daughter here. So I think that really, I think we really have to think about much more about the human aspect, you know, about how we do things. And really, you know, we have to give the minimum to provide the infrastructure, but not get caught maybe with the other aspect.
Thank you. I'm Marcela Escobari. I'm a fellow here at Global, day two. Yeah. So thank you very much for, does this work? Yeah. For the thoughtful discussion. I had a question about teachers. In a lot of the literature, it seems that the bottleneck for innovations to take hold on the issue of technology and other things tend to be teachers. And I just wanted to know whether there's any experiments, any examples that you've seen where you've been able to unlock that obstacle and scale it, right? Because there are examples, not in Latin America, in Asia, around the rise of private schools, these little private schools where they have better outcomes and teachers are paid, you know, one-fourth of the public school system. There are others, you know, there are little examples, but it seems that to be the binding constraint, and I'd love to hear if you have ideas of places that have unlocked it.
Hi, Maria Liliana Moore from the Trust for the Americas, Organization of American States. I was wondering if the IDB of the CAF have done any comparison of cognitive skills, so social-emotional skills, between formal education and non-formal or vocational education for vulnerable communities, and what are the findings? We really work a lot in non-formal education settings with persons with disabilities and at-risk youth and youth that have been incarcerated and working in correctional institutions and then working outside in job readiness training and cognitive skills. So I was wondering if you have made any study and a comparison between those settings.
One more? Okay, well, two more and then we'll close this round.
Hi, thanks. I'm Bridget Crumpton. I'm from the International Education Commission on Financing. So I just wanted to say thank you very much for this presentation. It was really, really interesting. And it chimes a lot with some of the findings that we have, particularly the need to focus on efficiency, on the early years, the gap that we see between kind of changes in the workforce and the kind of what types of skills schools are producing. Also, one of our key messages in the report is actually if you focus on results and what you want to achieve and then kind of work backwards on what type of policies or institutional changes you need to make to achieve them, that can work better. And how can we? So that might be something to pick up on. I think one thing picking up on the last set of questions too was around this role of teachers, because when you talked about budgets, we also know that inside those budgets, the lion's share of those budgets is on teachers. So if you can unlock that, you can have a very significant impact. So I think the question is, what kind of research do we need to do, or evidence generation do we need to do more around teachers? and particularly around this issue of socio-emotional skills, which are growing in importance, but where the evidence base is particularly weak. And then a flip question to that is, how do we also use the existing evidence that is there? Because we can see from the examples you gave that often governments are taking policy decisions that aren't based on evidence, like lengthening the school day, or in Indonesia recently they increased the salaries of all the teachers, but that had no impact on learning. So there is evidence out there, but the evidence is not often getting through. So I think there's another piece of this picture here, the kind of political economy piece on use of evidence. Interesting to hear your thoughts.
Last one. Hi, Maria Fernanda Sierra from the Trust for the Americas as well. And my question is related to adult education. Do you have any insights besides jobs, like learning and jobs and peer education, what you just briefly explained, related to adult education, thinking of people who didn't finish their formal education and are willing to either acquire new skills to access the job market or life skills to change their mindset? So if you have any evidence related to that, and also maybe if you can link that to Maria Liliana's questions about formal education or extracurricular education. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great questions. I'm glad I don't have to answer them. But anyway, Lucia, we'll start with you and then go to Julia.
Thank you. So regarding teachers, we can be here discussing a lot of evidence that is emerging now. Now we know that teachers are key. We as economists, because in the pedagogic and in the educational science world, they know this from since, I don't know, ever. But of course, now that we got to all these measures and all these value-added measures, that is makes us more sure about the attribution of what is the contribution of teachers to the process of skill formation of children. Now we know that teachers matter a lot. We have very few evidence from Latin America, and basically most of the evidence come from the work of the IDB, and especially in many things that have been doing Emiliana and your team. So maybe you can be more explicit about that evidence and what are the things that we still need to understand there. But the things that they were doing, for instance, in Ecuador, are very important for the region and to understand what is the role of teachers in the formation of both type of dimension, cognitive and non-cognitive. Regarding formal and non-formal education, we haven't done any review on non-formal education in this book, but we are very interested in this idea of non-formal settings for education, and it is related to your question on lifelong education and adult education. And it is especially these kind of things are especially important now that our world is changing so fast, and then we know that many of us maybe will be out of work will be more frequently out of work as compared to our parents, let's say. Going in and out of work is something that we should expect in the near future, so institutions need to adapt to this new reality in the labor markets, and these non-formal settings for training for education will be very important in the future, so we are committed to an agenda in trying to understand these things better. And I liked your question about the political economy of using evidence very much, because this is important, but it's also very important the political economy of producing evidence. We have very few evidence on some domains, especially because there is a lot of opposition in some us in some parts or with some governmental officials, we are not very good at convincing them how important it is to do these kind of things, to produce new evidence, but also because they have some incentives that are not very well aligned to producing good evidence on the things that they are doing. So we need to understand a lot more about the political economy of the production of evidence, but also, and I feel more optimistic about the political economy of the use of evidence. And I think that our kind of reports help a lot on that, because we have summarized in each of the chapters of our report. At the end, we summarize what is the state of the art, what is the rigorous evidence that we could use as governmental officials to design good policies. And we give there the state of the art, but of course it's not the complete set of information that we would like to have at hand to produce good policies or to design and implement good policies. But I think that our report helps and in the use of good evidence in the design and the implementation of policies. But in the production of new evidence, we are still very...
If I may add to that, I'm going to take advantage of my... I'll talk on both topics, but on the teacher side, I think there is, not just increasing evidence that they matter, but also what are the things about teachers that matter, or better yet, don't matter. So we know today that the years of education and what years of service don't really matter for making a great teacher. And instead, the type of practices that they had while being trained, the mentoring that they can receive, and actually what they do in classrooms is what makes a difference. There's, besides the work that we've been doing, which is, a very extensive study in one country, one of our colleagues and Barbara Berens from the World Bank did a very nice study looking at, with the Stallings method, looking at how teachers manage their classrooms in about 7 different countries of the region and comparing it to kind of the benchmark of how high-performing systems do it. Our teachers really spend a lot less time in instruction, in getting kids actually in the learning process, than in managing and disciplining and kind of organizing the day, or even in not being present. So that kind of data is very useful for governments to then use in their own training. We are currently finalizing about 4 years of work on looking at particular part of teacher policies, which has to do with how do we attract and select more talent into the profession. Because one of the also findings and one of the things we're documenting in this publication has to do with how over time the teaching profession, due to labor markets changes and sort of the evolution of how we as a region opened up access much faster than other regions with similar income, and to expand access in the way we did in the time we did, we had to have a lot more teachers in a relatively short period of time, and we kind of lowered our standards. At the same time, when women were having other opportunities in the labor market, and so the more talented women could now be engineers and lawyers, where in the past they couldn't. So all this is forthcoming, and I think we're looking forward to kind of sharing that and pushing an agenda of, not putting today's teacher in the situation where we're criticizing them because they're not responsible. It's really the way we valued the profession as societies that has over time been kind of the source of the problem. And then just the last comment on the political economy of producing and using evidence. I think that's not just an issue for education. I think that's an issue across sectors. And I also don't think it's just an issue for LAC. I mean, let's not even talk about what's happening in the White House at the moment on using data and evidence. But I did want to plug in two announcements, I guess. We have just launched just to backtrack on that, we are very committed also and working really hard like CAFES to try and facilitate data and evidence for education policymaking in our region. And one of the limitations has to do also with not only is most of the research evidence in academic journals and not really processed for policymakers, but also mostly in English. And so we are developing two initiatives which are complementary. One of them is CIMA, which stands for Centro de Información para el Mejoramiento de Aprendizajes, or Center for the Improvement of Learning Outcomes, CIMA. And it is basically a statistics portal that is user-friendly and that has all data from all other sources in a user-friendly way on education systems in our region. And it's in Spanish, Portuguese, as well as English. And then the second initiative is in partnership with the Fundación Chile, based in Santiago, to try and launch an innovation and research lab for our region called SUMA, S-U-M-M-A. And the idea is to have a platform where policymakers can go and sort of find the latest evidence, you know, that these kinds of reports produce, but up to date in Spanish and Portuguese and English, because we also work with the English-speaking Caribbean countries, but also to go beyond what works into kind of why does that work? What are the kind of implementation guidelines? Someone was talking about the importance of implementation. So if a program is successful, then we are, SUMA is going to actually document how it was implemented and what were some of the problems in implementation as well as successes so that others don't make the same mistake. And lastly, it has sort of the spirit of promoting innovation that is you know, trying new things so that, as someone was saying, teachers are more free and have more data and more possibilities of accessing innovation. So just a plug on that, and I'll maybe let you respond finally, and then we'll close.
Very good. I'm going to add a little things because I think the questions were covered really well by Lucila and Emiliana. About the question of socio-emotional skills, about formal and non-formal environments. As part of the flagship that we are going to put out this year, there's going to be a review of different interventions that focus specifically on developing socio-emotional skills that could be done in formal or non-formal environments. And let me tell you that the results are kind of quite positive, that they are basically it seems that they are experiencing some evidence saying that we can improve skills, formal, non-formal, it depends sometimes on the type of skill. The only issue there is that the evidence is mainly coming from very small studies, maybe in times randomized, but very small, where it's difficult to go from there to say to a country, launch this program and it's going to work. So I think that we have kind of a step that we need to go beyond that. It's like, let's do a large scale, well done, let's make sure that this works at scale before we really try to recommend these two countries. But I think that there is some basis, and psychologists have worked a lot on this, and they have done great work on that. About the issues of using existing evidence, I completely agree. That's a big issue, and there are several initiatives. The Education Division is I think, the two initiatives that Emilia talked about, they are going to be great. And also the flagship that we're going to produce this year, together with the flagship, we are going to launch a web page that basically provides the evidence on skill development along the life cycle in a systematic way. So it basically systemizes evidence. And the goal here is to make it easier for policymakers and anybody that want to have an informed opinion to go and look at the evidence and then take their decision. So the last question is a really tough one. It's about all of the education and how we can improve skills and labor outcomes of individuals, especially of those with low, basically that they haven't accumulated much skill up to that point, and so what do we do? And to be honest, that our vice president that is, you know, above us, is the question that he's been driving us. He's like, think about that guy. Think about the guy that is 20 years old. He dropped out from secondary school. He has 40 years ahead of him in the labor market. What do we do with him or her? So, unfortunately, the evidence is so far we know about something that don't work, but we don't know much about what works. And I think that there is really a need there for experimenting and for working about what we can do, and even in the margin. Maybe the effects are not going to be huge, but we need to think about these people and how we can improve. Clearly, for people that have a good basis. As Lucilia mentioned, you know, they arrive to, they are 18 year old and they have all good general skills, then acquiring specific skills is much easier. So, but the big issue is the people that are 18 and don't have it. So it's a big question that we have to work going forward.
So our time together has come to an end. On behalf of Brookings Global Program, I wanted to thank our presenter, our commentator, and all of you for being here. Thank you very much.